You know, yesterday, Andrea and I, and to a lesser degree, our daughter Lauren, spent a significant part of the day on the road, driving around town and even outside of town. The day started pretty early, and we drove to Georgetown for a birthday party in the park. And this is a park that we'd been to a couple times before, but we had never been there on our own. We had always followed someone there. And so from the time that we arrived in Georgetown, by which I mean that we were still on the freeway, but we were in Georgetown, near our exit, at any moment exiting the freeway, to the time that we actually arrived at the park, 40 minutes. You know what I'm saying, don't you? I mean, we missed our exit, and we got off and turned around and couldn't find the exit coming the other way, and we got back on and exited, and what, I don't even know if it was the right one or the wrong one. Drove around in circles, stopped to get directions, tried to make phone calls, 40 minutes. Finally, we arrive at the party in Georgetown. We missed about 30 minutes of the 90-minute party by the time we actually did arrive. Well, if that were the only thing that went wrong, I wouldn't even be making this my sermon introduction. But the problem is that coming home, well, my wife's truck was at Walmart in Round Rock, and so we had to stop there to get it. Now, if you know that intersection, I-35 and 1825, I mean, that is hell on earth. If you want to know what hell is about, just spend a portion of your day at that intersection, and I think maybe that's it. So after waiting through multiple traffic lights just to get into that parking lot and pick up that truck, I had a bright idea. I said, let's not go home that way. Instead, let's kind of head east into Round Rock, and somewhere back there is that 635 that as you go south, it turns into Desaw, and I'm thinking, that would be a much faster way to get home. Well, we start going in that direction, and pretty soon it's pouring rain, and we're lost. We have absolutely no idea, really, what direction we're going, north, south, east, west, you know, where is this 635? We seem to be at a dead end, and to make matters worse, there in the rain, the wiper blade has come off on my wife's truck, and so I'm getting out of my truck and I'm fixing the wiper blade on hers and trying to figure out where in the world we're going to go. We don't even want to go back to that intersection, you know. And so we end up asking for directions again and finally getting where we're going. If that were all that happened yesterday, I wouldn't be using this as my sermon introduction. But see, then, before we had to leave town for Brenham, well, Lauren didn't really want to spend the day driving to Brenham, so we were supposed to hurriedly take her across town to spend the rest of the afternoon and evening with a friend. And so I'm taking her. We have to hurry. The person we're rendezvousing with has major time constraints, and I'm just going to take Breaker, you know, west, just right across town. I'm going to take Breaker. And so what happens? Breaker is completely shut down, completely barricaded, huge red fire trucks, police cars, lights, people in uniforms. So we have to detour and go all the way around. If that were the only thing that happened yesterday, this wouldn't be my sermon introduction. So finally, Andrea and I, you know, Lauren is where she's supposed to go, and so now we're ready to head for Brenham. Once again, we're taking two vehicles because we're, you know, rendezvousing, and somebody's going to drive one of the vehicles for the next month or so. Long story short. So here we are. We're driving to Brenham. We haven't been on the road for about 5-10 minutes. You know, we're just getting on the 290 to head in that general direction. Andrea calls me from her cell phone to my cell phone, and the AC has gone out in the vehicle that she's driving. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm not going anywhere without air conditioning. I mean, that's just like, but she's tougher than I am. So she rolls down her windows and, you know, follows me, which means high rates of speed, massive wind conditions inside the truck that she's driving, and we finally get all the way down there. Well, see, all of these things, my goodness, it just kind of makes me wish that, I don't know, we'd stayed in bed or something, you know, and not have taken all these trips. But you see, I should have known this was going to happen. I totally set myself up for this. It's all my fault because on Friday, I bought this. That's right, the same guys that brought you a year and a half ago the worst-case scenario survival handbook have a sequel. It's the worst-case scenario survival handbook travel. This was my mistake, buying this book. I mean, it says right here in the introduction, the statistics are against you. More than 50% of all travelers run into problems. While we hope that the worst that you'll ever encounter is a seat back that won't recline or a dripping sink in your hotel room, there is a lot more that could go wrong. Hijackings, leeches, runaway trains, tarantulas, tsunamis, severed limbs, muggings, plane crashes, brake failure, UFO abduction. UFO abduction. Maybe a hotel fire while you're sleeping on the 33rd floor. They say our advice is simple. Always be ready for the worst. I mean, they've got chapters like how to survive a riot, how to find your way without a compass, how to survive in frigid water. Well, so as I'm checking all this out, I'm thinking, man, you know what? This isn't original. These guys full-on plagiarized 2 Corinthians chapter 11. Because this is all the stuff that the Apostle Paul talks about. When it came to the worst-case scenario, the Apostle Paul, well, he wrote the book. Now, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself because there's a paragraph that we need to just sort of skim through before we set ourselves up for what we want to focus on. Look with me, 2 Corinthians 11, verse 16. He writes, I say then, let no one think me a fool. If otherwise, at least receive me as a fool, that I also may boast a little. What I speak not according to the Lord, but as it were foolishly, in this confidence of boasting. Seeing that many boast according to the flesh, I also will boast. For you put up with fools gladly, since you yourselves are wise. For you put up with it if one brings you into bondage, if one devours you, if one takes from you, if one exalts himself, if one strikes you on the face. To your shame, I say that we were too weak for that. But in whatever anyone is bold, I speak foolishly, I am bold also. Well, Paul is talking about these so-called spiritual leaders that had followed him into Corinth and were now building up a following after themselves at Paul's expense. And he tells us in verse 18 that these so-called spiritual leaders had chosen to boast. And so Paul had no choice but to boast. But in verse 17, Paul admits that that's really not Christ-like. In other words, that wasn't something that Jesus had ever thought it was necessary to do, necessary to fall back on. But he may have been thinking, Paul that is, of Proverbs 26, verse 5, which says, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. And so Paul is answering these fools according to their folly. They were boasting, and now Paul is going to boast too. Note the use of irony in verses 19 and 21. Verse 19, since you yourselves are wise. In verse 21, we were too weak for that. Inspired irony, if not sanctified sarcasm. But I especially want to draw your attention to Paul's concerns as expressed in verse 20. There's five things that he mentions there. First of all, he talks about those that would bring them into bondage, that is, spiritually, by teaching religion instead of teaching a relationship with God. And then he talks about those who devour you, that is, financially, by exploiting them, by taking advantage of their right to be supported. And then he talks about those who take from you. You'll notice the word from in the New King James Version is italicized. It means it's not in the Greek, but it's supplied by the translators to help it make sense. But really, the idea is probably better, takes you. In other words, they take you. You've been taken. And that is emotionally. They were smitten with these spiritual leaders. And then he talks about those who would exalt themselves, that is, pridefully. Exalting themselves rather than exalting the Lord. It was self-exaltation. And then finally in verse 20, those who strike you on the face. That is, abusively. It was at least a figure of speech referring to those who would verbally abuse and publicly embarrass them, but perhaps even more specifically, people who would physically abuse them by hitting them. It's hard for us perhaps to imagine that some people will allow spiritual leaders to do these kinds of things, but of course you only have to reflect for a moment on some of the more noted examples in recent times. For example, Jim Jones in Jonestown, the Jonestown Massacre, or even more recently than that and closer to home than that, David Koresh and his compound outside of Waco, or even more recently, Marshall Applewhite. Remember, he led the group called Heaven's Gate that committed suicide in Rancho Santa Fe. And so realizing just how far this sort of thing can go and how much damage it can do, it's as if Paul is just, you know, responding to that. And so it's no wonder that he feels as strongly as he does. It's no wonder that he's prepared, if necessary, to resort to boasting, to both prove his love for the church in Corinth and to protect them from these spiritual leaders that we've talked about. So as he boasts, as he goes on, beginning in verse 22, to tell us about himself and about some of his exploits, Well, we're getting sort of a behind-the-scenes look at the Apostle Paul, because it's not just what he did, but why he did it. Maybe you've seen the television commercial by Ford Motor Company, which says this. It says, because it's more than just what you drive, it's what drives you. And that gives me the title for my message this morning. My title is, What Drives You? And we're going to see that there were specifically three things that drove the Apostle Paul. Number one, if you're taking notes, this is our outline. Number one, love for the lost, verses 22 to 27. Number two, love for the church, verses 28 and 29. And then number three, love for the Lord, verses 30 through 33. So what drives you? Well, let's begin with love for the lost in verse 22. Paul says, are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they the seed of Abraham? So am I. Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more. Well, let's stop right there. If you are taking notes, you could jot down Philippians 3, verse 5, because there Paul gives almost the same credentials, but in reverse order. And without actually reading that verse, I'll draw from it. Notice here in verse 22 the reference to Abraham. Are they the seed of Abraham? So am I. Well, Paul is identifying with the covenant that God made with Abraham. Paul tells us in the Philippians passage that he was circumcised on the eighth day. That was the sign of that covenant. Notice in verse 22 the reference to Israelites. The Philippians 3:5 passage tells us that he was actually a Benjamite. See Israel? Well, he had 12 sons. Those 12 sons give us the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. Paul was a descendant of Benjamin, Israel's youngest son. And then notice also in verse 22 the reference to Hebrews. In New Testament times, a Hebrew was a Jew who followed Hebrew culture, while a Hellenist was a Jew who followed Greek culture. Well, Paul was not just a Hebrew, but according to that Philippians 3:5 passage, he was a Hebrew of the Hebrews. It's kind of like saying that someone is a man's man. You know, he was a Hebrew's Hebrew. So, I mean, he followed the Hebrew culture, and he followed it full on. But notice when we get to verse 23, the reference to Christ. Because, see, here the comparison ends. No longer is he simply saying, so am I, so am I, so am I. Now he says, I am more. I am more. So look in verse 23, right where we left off. He says, in labors more abundant, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequently, in deaths often. From the Jews 5 times I received 40 stripes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was stoned. Now again, let's stop right there. When Paul became a Christian, it's recorded for us back in Acts 9. In verse 16, we see something very, very interesting. I'll just quote it. And this is where God is speaking to someone else about Paul immediately following his conversion. And here's what God says, I will show him, that is Paul, how many things he must suffer for my name's sake. So from the very time that Paul became a Christian, he knew and understood that there was going to be a price to pay. He knew that he was going to suffer even physically because of this radical transformation of his life. And the things that we've read so far through that first part of verse 25, well, these are things that he suffered at the hands of people, specifically because of his commitment to Christ and of his commitment to serving Christ as an evangelist and as a missionary. In verse 23, you notice the words, we'll just highlight them, labors, stripes, prisons, deaths. It's sort of a general summary of the things that Paul experienced. It's kind of the New Testament equivalent of lions and tigers and bears. Oh my, you know. It's his way of telling us, here in a nutshell is what I went through. But now he says, let me give you some more of the details. Let me give you some specific examples. Verse 24, we learn what he suffered at the hands of the Jews. It says, 5 times I received 40 stripes minus one. Well, when you received stripes, when you were scourged by the Jews, your hands were bound to a pillar. And the ruler of the synagogue used a calf-hide whip. It says here that he received 40 stripes minus one. See, Deuteronomy 25 verse 3 said that 40 was the maximum number of stripes that you could give a prisoner in punishing them. And so the Jews were only giving 39, just in case. just to be on the safe side. They didn't want to mess up. They didn't want to have lost count and accidentally give a 41st stripe, thinking it was the 40th. So, you know, what a break. Only 39. You didn't get the 40th lash. But here's the interesting thing that you might not have considered, and that is that as the ruler of the synagogue did this, well, you would receive one-third of the stripes on your chest, two-thirds of the stripes on your back. It says that this happened to him five times. Now, even at only 39 stripes, that's 195 stripes. That's a whole lot of stripes, isn't it? When you think again about the chest and the back, well, that's 65 scars across his chest. That's 130 scars across his back. What he suffered at the hands of the Jews. What did he suffer at the hands of the Gentiles? Look again at verse 25. Three times I was beaten with rods, once I was stoned. Beaten with rods. These rods were birch or elm, and they would be bound together in a bundle. So three times he was beaten this way. And then it says, once I was stoned. Somebody will say, well, at least Paul admitted that he inhaled, you know, unlike some other leaders I know about. Well, no, that's not it at all. To be stoned in Bible times, that would mean basically, I'll put it as simply as I can, people threw rocks at you until you died. And that's just a bad thing, isn't it? I mean, when I was a kid, did you ever play that game where you go, would you rather die this way or that way? You'd lay out two scenarios. You know, our daughter springs that on us every now and then, and you know, she'll name some grisly thing, and we're like, where did you get that? You know, nobody, you haven't seen that, or what? How do you know? Why would you even want to think about that? But I remember when I was a kid, we'd do the same thing. And we'd say, well, I'd rather die this way, you know, and we're all brave, of course, as we have the conversation. Well, stoning, nobody picked stoning, okay? When I was a kid, nobody ever said, I'd like to be stoned. Just something that never came up. The idea that people were literally, there were rocks everywhere in Israel. If you visit with us next year, you'll see that that's still true. And to have people throwing rocks at you until you died, that's just absolutely horrible. And when this happened to Paul, Acts 14, verse 19 tells us that he was left for dead. He was left for dead. Wow. Well, see, you and I might say, gee, I'm glad God didn't say Acts 9:16 to me when I got saved. I'm glad God didn't say to me that I was going to have to suffer great things, but actually, he did. He did, because 2 Timothy 3, verse 12 says this, yes, and all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. So that's something that God says to each and every one of us. Now, it's true that not every unbeliever is going to persecute Christians. Proverbs 16, verse 7 says, when a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. So sometimes we have good relationships with unbelievers. But it's also true that some Christians are persecuted for something other than their faith. If you're carrying a King James version of the Bible, Old King as we call it, 1 Peter 2 verse 9 says, but ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, an holy nation, a peculiar people. And some Christians have taken that literally, and they think we're supposed to all be peculiar, you know? And so we get persecuted not for Christ's sake, but for weirdness' sake, because we're just so bizarre that people give us a hard time, and rightfully so. But you know what? All of that aside, it is also true that Christians are promised persecution. And don't miss this point, that a lack of persecution is cause for concern. Jesus said in Luke 6, verse 26, woe to you when all men speak well of you, for so did their fathers to the false prophets. You know, J.I. Packer, he said that opposition is a fact. And he said the Christian who is not conscious of being opposed had better watch himself, for he is in danger. George MacLeod said the greatest criticism of the church today is that no one wants to persecute it because there is nothing very much to persecute it about. If you've been a Christian for very long, I want to ask you, do you remember a time when people gave you a hard time for being a Christian? I mean, I gave my life to Christ when I was a teenager, and I remember very well being given a hard time, being given a hard time at school. I remember, for example, one time in typing class, they had desks that sat two people, and I was sitting next to, you know, a girl that was in a class in the same grade, and I was sharing with her throughout that particular semester, and she wasn't very responsive. And one particular day in class, it was really quiet in class, and so we were having to speak in pretty, you know, hushed tones, and I was kind of laying it on, you know, kind of sharing with her, and finally, in a moment of frustration, she just said out loud, but it's not socially acceptable to be a Christian. Every head turned in the classroom. And they weren't looking at her in disbelief. They were looking at me in disgust. It was like they all agreed, like, will you leave her alone? Will you stop with this Jesus freak stuff? And I got a lot of that. But you know what? I don't get that much of that anymore. And I'll bet you there's others here, too, who would say, you know what? I really don't have much problem being a Christian anymore. And gosh, what does that say? I mean, is the world really becoming that much more tolerant of Christians? I don't think so. I have a feeling that perhaps it's a better indicator that we're not being salt and light, that our lives aren't the bold witness they were before, that instead we have in some respects compromised ourselves. So we need to think about all of this. But notice also the things that Paul goes on to say, beginning right where we left off in verse 25. He says, three times I was shipwrecked, a night and a day I have been in the deep, in journeys often, in perils of waters, in perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, in perils of the Gentiles, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren, in weariness and toil and sleeplessness often, in hunger and thirst and fastings often, in cold and nakedness. Now, these are not things that happened specifically because Paul was a Christian. These are not things that we should understand in exactly the same way. Although to a degree that's true, it's also true that some of these things just happened to Paul by virtue of the fact that he traveled as extensively as he did. And we know he did that for Christ. But these are things that might have happened to anyone that traveled like that. Travel in Bible times is extremely difficult. Nothing like it is today. I mean, it was considered a calculated risk to travel. So much so that people settled their affairs before setting out on a journey. So that kind of gives us an idea, doesn't it, what it must have been like. I mean, Paul needed my book. You know, he really could have used one of these. He would have been in lots of situations turning quickly and trying to find out what he ought to do at that particular moment. Notice in verse 25 that he was shipwrecked. In fact, it tells us that on one occasion he spent 24 hours in the water. Paul was the original castaway. And the thing about it is that this was written before the shipwreck that we read about in Acts 27 took place. I mean, I've said before, you had to be crazy to travel with Paul. This guy was like the perfect storm just waiting to happen. Anytime he gets in a boat, bad things take place. Notice in verse 26, in journeys and waters, the word waters there refers to rivers. And then robbers and Jews, his countrymen, and Gentiles. He was a marked man. Everywhere he went, a marked man. Notice in the city and in the wilderness and in the sea. Now, whereas waters meant rivers, sea here means just that, the sea, like the Mediterranean Sea. And then notice among false brethren, for example, the so-called spiritual leaders in Corinth. Well, what follows reads very much like chapter 6, verse 5, a section that we covered some weeks ago. But you'll notice in verse 27 the reference to weariness and toil. It's talking about the job that he did. Outside of his ministry, he was a tent maker. And then it talks about sleeplessness. He didn't have a problem with insomnia. The idea is that oftentimes he was skipping sleep because he was bivocational, both a minister and a tent maker. Perhaps it also has special reference to his prayer life. And then notice hunger and thirst. Because he insisted on not taking support in so many of the cities where he ministered, but supporting himself, and because he was bivocational and burning the candle at both ends, perhaps there were times that he didn't have everything he needed, and he was hungry or he was thirsty. And then also notice the word fastings, which may not necessarily refer to fasting for spiritual reasons, but even to skipping meals for the same reasons that he skipped sleep, because he was so busy. And then notice also the reference to cold and to nakedness. There were times when he didn't even have enough clothing and so forth. You know, as I read all that, I think about some of the experiences that I've had. Not that there's really much comparison, but you know, as a pretty young Christian, as a teenager, just out of high school, I guess I was 18, 19 years old, I had the opportunity to travel to Hong Kong and then on into China. And many of you have heard me tell the story about smuggling Bibles into China. And because our feeling was, there were four of us, our feeling was that if one of us got arrested, we didn't want all of us to get arrested. So when we got off the train, we all went in different directions as if we didn't know each other. And unknown to me, I thought I was the last one to go through customs. I was actually the first one to come through customs. And so when I came out of the station that we passed through and I didn't see any of my buddies, I thought they'd gone on to the hotel without me. And so I started wandering around China, Canton or Guangzhou. I start wandering around trying to find the floating flower. Do you know what it's like being in a foreign country where you don't speak the language and you can't find anybody who speaks English? I mean, I was walking into business establishments going, the floating flower, and hearing things in return I couldn't understand. You know, gung-ho, beef and broccoli, I don't know what they're saying. Where is the floating flower? That's all I need to know is floating flower, and nothing was working. Well, eventually, after wandering around for a long time, I found the floating flower. And there in front was the rest of the gang who, it turns out, had come through behind me and found that I was gone. They were scared to death, wondered what had happened to me. So you can't take me anywhere. You can't drive to Brenham. You can't go to China. Then there was the time I led a team of 8 from our church to Europe a few years ago. And half of us went into Serbia on a train. This is before we bombed them. Obviously, I don't think I'd want to go to Serbia right now. Half of us went in on the train and half of us were driven to the border where we were supposed to walk across the border and have a ride waiting on the other side. Well, I led the group that went across the border. When we crossed the border, it took so long to get through customs. The guy hassled us and asked us questions and wanted to know how much money we had and on it went. Well, our ride thought that we must have come in the train like the rest of the group, and so they left without us. And so we came through, and our ride was not there. We couldn't get a hold of anybody, and so we started hitchhiking through Serbia. And so there's 4 of us with bags, and we found this guy in like, remember when Hondas first came out? And they were like basically like, say, Campbell's soup cans with tires on them. I mean, just the smallest vehicles imaginable. Well, here's this guy driving. Again, he barely speaks any English at all. But as soon as we start flashing German Deutschmarks, we're speaking the same language. You know, in Serbia, a German Deutschmark, I mean, that is of great, great value. Their money is almost worthless. You throw it away when you come home. It's not even worth saving. So he took our money. He was happy to do that. So we got 3 guys in the back seat that was probably this wide. You know, one guy in the front and bags in our laps. And then we were standing around in Subotica, Serbia, the city we're supposed to go with no idea where to go. Just hanging around the train station. Don't know anybody. Can't find anybody. Can't get anybody on the phone. Some armed officer took me off all by myself and interrogated me in a room and was giving us a hard time about who we were and why we were there. It was freaky. So I read this list of Paul's, and I'm thinking, well, you know, I've kind of had a couple of things that in hindsight are kind of fun, but at the time were pretty freaky. But Paul, you know, this stuff happened to Paul over and over and over. The way one commentator put it, instead of enjoying a comfortable, self-indulgent, egocentric Christianity, Paul reached the world of his day with courage and daring and vision that still leaves us breathless after 2,000 years. What Paul achieved for Christ in the days of slow travel and poor communication is staggering, but it was achieved at a cost. Now, why did Paul do that? Why was he willing to pay the price that he paid? Well, I believe it was because he was driven by love for the lost. I believe Paul knew Proverbs 11, verse 30, which says, "He who wins souls is wise." I believe Paul knew Daniel 12, verse 3, which tells us that those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. I believe that Paul had embraced in his heart what Jesus said in Matthew 28, beginning in verse 19. He said, "Go therefore and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them," he continues, "to observe all things that I have commanded you." Paul had taken that to heart. We call it the Great Commission. We don't call it the Great Suggestion. There's a reason for that. And that's because every Christian is called to evangelism. Every Christian is called to give away their faith. The thing about Paul is that when he gave his faith away, people knew that he cared. There's a story about someone who was talking to a friend about his church. And his friend related that they'd gotten a new pastor. And he said, "Well, what was wrong with the old pastor?" And he said, "Well, the old pastor, all he ever did is tell us that we were going to hell." He said, "Really? Well, what's the new pastor like? What does he do?" He said, "Well, the new pastor tells us that we're going to hell too." He said, "Well, what's the difference? Why did you make the switch?" And he said, "Well, when the old pastor told us that we were going to hell, he seemed happy about it. But," he said, "when the new pastor tells us that we're going to hell, we can see that his heart is broken." You know, there's a saying that people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And they could see how that Paul truly cared about them. As a church, I believe that we truly care. And you know what? We're seeing some exciting things happen. I don't know if you realize this, but here we are in early May or nearly mid-May, and not taking into consideration any of the events that we've done off-site that God has blessed wildly, even beyond our expectations. Just on our Sunday morning and Wednesday evening services, we've already seen over 100 decisions made for Christ this year. That's awesome. Because every one of those decisions represents a life changed. And that's just it. Lives are changing. I'm hearing testimonies all the time right now about people who just this year have given their life to Christ here in our church and who have taken dramatic steps. People who have been drug dealers and people whose marriages were over and God's brought restoration. Story after story about the amazing things that God has done. But what about as individuals? Let me ask you this. How much is a soul worth to you? Because Paul recognized the value of a human soul. And he lived as if he wanted people to get saved. He was willing to pay the price. Have you ever prayed, God, make me willing to do what it takes to reach other people with your love? Have you ever prayed, God, help me to become the evangelist that you want me to be? Help me to just use the gifts that you've given me. Help me within the way that you've wired me to give my faith away. Have you ever prayed, God, would you give me opportunities to share my faith in the workplace? God, would you give me opportunities to share my faith with my neighbors? God, would you open doors for me to share my faith with my family? Do you ever pray like that? It's dangerous praying because God will take you seriously. And he will answer. And we ought to pray like that. Somebody said, evangelize or fossilize. And it's true. Well, not only was he driven by his love for the lost, but much more quickly we want to look at his love for the church and his love for the Lord. Look with me at verse 28. Paul says, besides the other things, what comes upon me daily, that is my deep concern for all the churches. Who is weak, and I am not weak? Who is made to stumble, and I do not burn with indignation? So here, the word concern in verse 28, it means anxiety. It means care that brings disruption to the personality and the mind. That's how deeply he felt, not just about lost people, but about the church itself. Interesting the comparison that Paul makes. Those things that were happening outside of him, they were nothing compared to what was happening inside of him. Those things that happened to him from time to time, well, they were nothing compared to what was happening inside of him all of the time. Verse 29, we learn that he felt their pain. We learn that he was angry with the adversary, the devil. We learn that he was angry with their adversaries, their so-called spiritual leaders. He cared deeply about the church in Corinth, just as he cared deeply about churches everywhere he went. He was driven by love for the church. I want to focus on that for just the next few minutes. It's something I've talked about before. And I'm going to return to it over and over again because it's so important and because I feel so strongly about it. We probably all know someone subscribing to the cliche, I can worship God better walking in the woods than I can inside of a building. The problem, of course, is they do so little wood walking. I mean, when was the last time they got up on a Sunday morning and went to the woods and took a walk and, like, worshiped God? They don't do that. They're probably in bed right now, you know. They're worshiping in the woods, all right. They're dreaming, you know, that they're on some exotic safari somewhere. But people say that. It's just a lame excuse for not being involved, for not being plugged in. The amazing thing is that two-thirds of churched people agree with that. And we need to understand that God is not localized. God is not inside these four walls, but not outside of them. It's not like we can walk out of the building today and as soon as we get in the parking lot, you know, hey, I can let my hair down now because God's in there and he doesn't know. No, God is everywhere. And it's true. We can worship him at home, in the car, wherever we go. We can worship him. It's absolutely true. But it's absolutely untrue that that means there's no need for us to be together. Hebrews 10, verse 24. Let us consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works. Verse 25, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. That's God's will for us, that we would be fellowshipping with one another, that we would be committed to a local church, that we would be relationship building there and involved there. This week, my wife had a conversation with a man who is a professing Christian, a man who sends his child or his children to private school to a Christian school, and as she was volunteering and serving alongside of him, and they were talking about things, she asked him, well, where do you go to church? And he said, well, we don't really have a home church. And he dropped a couple of names of places that, you know, they had visited. And, of course, Andrea was familiar with those places, and so she picked out one of them and named the pastor. And he said, you know, I don't really know who the pastor is there. I guess I've been there a couple times. I mean, that's pretty bad. When you're a believer, but the church that you name is one of the churches that you go to, you don't even know who the pastor is. I mean, there's something wrong with this picture. And so he admitted, you know what, we don't really just go to one church every week. We just kind of, we go somewhere different. We kind of go here, we kind of go there. You know what, I'm sorry, but that's not God's plan. It's not God's plan. God's plan is that we would feel called by him to a particular place, that we would be committed to that place and serving in that place. As we were having that conversation, our daughter Lauren chimed in. She said, well, is that a sin, you know, to go to all the different churches, you know, not have a church home? Well, here's the thing. I mean, first of all, we talked about the Bible verses that say not to forsake meeting together. But in this case, there's not a forsaking. There's just like a smorgasbord. So what do you do with that? Well, here's my question to you. If you are what we call a church hopper, if you refuse to be cornered and pinned down and, you know, in one place, how are you going to fulfill the Bible verses that say one another? How are you going to do that? Well, like what? Love one another? I have warm fuzzies when I go to wherever I go. The word love there is a verb. It's not a noun. It's something that you do. It's not something that you feel. You've got to be in relationship with people to love them in the way the Bible says, love one another. What about serve one another? What about greet one another? What about all the other one another's? I mean, there are so many of them. We covered six in a series last year, but there are several times more than that. How are you going to do what the Bible says to do in body life, if you're just bouncing around? You can't do it. For a lot of us, it's simply the fact that we don't want to be committed. It's the fact that we don't want to be accountable. We like the anonymity of no one knowing who we are or what we do or how we live. We just kind of want to be able to scratch our religious itch. But we're falling far short of what God has in mind for the Christian life. Can I encourage you that one of the most important things you might do if you are a church hopper is to decide today, whether it's here or somewhere else, that's not my business, but to decide between you and God that you are going to plug in and get committed somewhere. That's perhaps one of the most important things that you could do right now. And your spiritual life can take off as a result of that. And that's why we say that it's not just about believing, but it's about belonging. Christians believe, you bet, but they belong too. And Paul was not only motivated by his love for the lost and his love for the church, but he was motivated by his love for the Lord. Let's look in verse 30. Paul says, if I must boast, I will boast in the things which concern my infirmity. The God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who is blessed forever, knows that I am not lying. In Damascus, the governor under Aretas the king was guarding the city of the Damascenes with a garrison, desiring to apprehend me. But I was let down in a basket through a window in the wall and escaped from his hands. If you want to read all about that, you can. Jot down Acts 9, verses 19 through 25. Paul shares a story where these so-called spiritual leaders would have said, oh, Paul was a victim. Paul says, no, not a victim. I'm a victor. Because I relate all of these things, not in a victimization context, but in a victorious context. God is good, and I share these things because his goodness is seen in these things, Paul might have said. But notice his focus on God. And arguably on his love for God in verses 30 to 31. He was driven by love for the Lord. You guys have heard of headhunters, right? People that, you know, basically hire for other companies. There was one of these headhunters who was actually responsible for finding corporate executives for other firms. And he once told Josh McDowell, when I get an executive that I'm trying to hire for someone else, I like to disarm him. Offer him a drink, take my coat off, then my vest, undo my tie, throw my feet up, talk about baseball, football, family, whatever, until he's relaxed. And then when I think I've got him relaxed, I lean over, look him square in the eye, and say, what's your purpose in life? It's amazing how top executives fall apart at that question, he says. And what about you this morning? What drives you? What is your purpose in life? In some respects, it may be harder to live for Christ than to die for him. Jim Elliot said, I seek not a long life, but a full one, like you, Lord Jesus. Jim Elliot said, he is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. He died not long after that, January 8th, 1956, martyred by the Aka Indians in South America. But you know what? It's not the years here that count. It's what we do with those years. How we invest those years. What we do with our lives. So I want to ask you this morning, you know, if this was it for you, today was your last day, if your soul was going to be demanded of you before the day was over, which it will be one day, and if God were to write a single word to summarize your whole life, what would that word be? And think about that. Consider what that means. There's a lot of people who are going to have regrets when they look back on their life. You don't want to get to that point and realize that you wasted your life on stuff that didn't matter. You don't want to do that. Remember Paul. Remember how driven he was. Remember what drove him. That story about the headhunter, that ends like this. He says, "Well, I was interviewing this fellow the other day, had him all disarmed with my feet up on his desk, talking about football. And then I leaned up and said, 'What's your purpose in life, Bob?' And he said, without blinking an eye, 'To go to heaven and to take as many people with me as I possibly can.' And the headhunter says, 'For the first time in my career, I was speechless.'" May that be our response. May our response be very much like that. As we start to understand what it means to be driven in a godly way, to become the kind of person that Paul was, the kind of Christian that Paul was, the kind of difference maker that Paul was.